I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Professor Thomas Hazlett. Professor Hazlett's research focuses on the public choice and public policy aspects of regulatory measures in the communications sector. The focus of his 2017 book, The Political Spectrum, The Tumultuous Liberation of Wireless Technology, From Herbert Hoover to the Smartphone, debunks the traditional view as to why the radio spectrum is allocated and licensed by regulators. He argues that contrary to popular belief, radio broadcasting actually developed according to common law property rules, and the 1927 move to political control was less motivated by a necessity to impose order on a chaotic system than as a result to pressure by incumbent radio stations and key policymakers, like Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, to foreclose competitive entry. He maintains that these developments have inhibited innovation rather than encouraged it. And Professor Hazlett's research, of course, has implications for public policy in this country, with issues like 5G and net neutrality, both areas of debate for present-day communication regulation. Professor Hazlett, thank you very much for joining the IEA today.
It's a delight to be here.
Excellent. Now, I wonder if you might start by explaining what the radio spectrum actually is for those who might not know.
Well, it's an invisible resource, and it has seemed quite mysterious for a long time. Radio is like a magic trick. You're communicating through dead space. And while we initially were able to construct and somewhat understand a wired communication where you send electricity and translate it into sound signals from one end to the other, wireless was a great advance, and indeed, it's a technology named for what it's not. Mm-hmm. You're taking away the wire, and yet you're getting the communications. Now, those communications travel through space, not the atmosphere, not a gas, which originally was thought to be ether, but just between points in the universe, you can have electrical impulses that are sent by one radio and received by another. And of course, they can go back and forth interactively. And the modern world of wireless communications is a testament to that. The battle over radio spectrum is who owns those spaces? What rules are there? And the idea was originally that there would be great conflict between competing users of radio space. A cacophony of competing voices might destroy the entire enterprise of wireless. And so the government has to step in and make sure there's an orderly, top-down planning of everything that actually is communicated. That turns out to be false.
So, and what sort of things in our daily lives use the spectrum? Just to give an example.
Right. Well, everything from listening to an FM radio broadcast to using a remote control to enter your car to, using a mobile phone to make a phone call, a text, or download some music on Spotify.
And then what do you mean by the political spectrum? Why did you feel compelled to write your book?
Because originally in the United States, which is the key market here, it's not so different from everywhere else, but it really goes first and it leads the way in terms of its influence on what happens elsewhere. In the United States, there was a first-come, first-served system that really did quite a handy job of regulating access to airwaves after the development of broadcasting. Radio broadcasting, where the issue of conflict in wireless becomes an issue for the first time. That starts in 1920. For several years, there actually is a first-come, first-serve regime in place, and radio develops. It becomes wildly popular. By 1926, 4 million U.S. households have radios. Now, these are not the little radios we, you know, cheap and small we think of today. These were these massive consoles that cost about $1,500 to $2,000 in today's money. And investments like that were made by households because the services were being delivered under essentially property rules. And so there was a successful innovation taking place, but it is politicized. What happens in 1927 is that there is an actual overturn of the existing regime. In the 1927 Radio Act, the first sentence says that no private party can ever assert a property right, a vested use of the airwaves. And the government takes over with what's called the public interest standard, where a commission, literally appointed by the president, confirmed by the U.S. Senate, will make determinations as to what technologies, what business models, what services, and what applications can go through radio space. The ostensible rationale is that you would have chaos otherwise. The actual motivation was, as you mentioned, a political coalition of incumbent radio stations and incumbent politicians wanted more control and less competition. And that's what they got with politicization in the Radio Act, and that's why I call it the political spectrum.
But that leads me on to the next question then. So how is this regulatory framework that has come from that political battleground used to protect the incumbents, to protect the existing players?
So a great example is shortly after the Radio Act, a great inventor, one of the greatest of the 20th century, Edwin Howard Armstrong, comes up with a better mousetrap for radio, and it's called FM, frequency modulation. And he says it makes music sound beautiful and high fidelity, far better, far superior to AM radio, which he was, in fact, the primary inventor in the patents used by the Radio Corporation of America. So he went to the regulators under the Radio Act to get access to radio spectrum. It took him years, but he finally was able to get permission for the use of a band. And before World War II comes to the United States, he sells 500,000 radios, and a network was built in the Northeast. Then during the war, all civilian production stops. At the end of the war, the analysts are saying he's going to sell 5 million radios a year. FM is beautiful. It's got this great, great sound. The reviews have been outstanding, and now it's going to take off. But what happens is the regulator comes back, and as a favor to the emerging television interests, they simply eliminate FM radio's allocation of radio waves. They put it on another part of the dial, which there was no technology for, and completely ruined the industry for many years, made all the radios obsolete. And in fact, Edwin Howard Armstrong, perplexed, frustrated, and humiliated, commits suicide.
Wow.
Okay, so this is Mother May I. This is what the actual regulators have called it on many occasions, a system where you might build a better mousetrap. You might have a wireless device that has potential to be the most popular ever, but you have to ask government officials in their infinite wisdom, do they think it's in the public interest to deploy this? And they have to be the ones to assign the radio rights. The alternative to that is that there's a market in owned rights, and an innovator goes to Wall Street or anybody who wants to take a chance and says, look, I'd like to get some backing for this idea. Let's buy some radio rights and let's try. Let's, like any other market, we'll put together the product. The customer gets to judge. That doesn't happen in radio traditionally because the government has to determine that the airwaves can be used for a particular service. Mm-hmm. And that's what killed FM for 30 years and Edwin Howard Armstrong, literally.
To the extent that you agree with the statement that government intervention or government stifling of the market has occurred, how much do you think this has hindered innovation? In how much further along would we be with, say, the iPhone, for example, I don't know, or any other technology would we be if it hadn't been for, in those early days, that stifling and blocking of innovation within the market?
Well, there's simply no question that there have been decades of deterrence for technological innovation. I mean, you ask people, when was the cell phone technology invented? And, you know, people say, oh, 1968 or 1981. In fact, on July 28th, 1945, there was a story in the most popular U.S. magazine, the Saturday Evening Post, from the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission in the U.S., talking about cellular technology as developed by AT&T Bell Labs. And he said in this article, oh, it'll just take a couple of years to get the licenses out. In fact, it took nearly 39 years to get the licenses out. And that kind of roadblock has been traditionally supplied with FM, with cellular, Cable TV, even though it's not wireless, it was competing with broadcast television. That was delayed by 15 or 20 years because broadcast was protected by the regulators against competition. So the relaxation, and there's an interesting and complicated story that neither I tell nor anyone else tells very well, but there was a relaxation, a liberalization, if you will, that really starts about the 1970s, 80s, and by the millennium becomes profound. That is to say that we now, particularly in the mobile markets, distribute rights to radio spectrum, generally by auction, most countries, the United States, the UK in particular, by auction to the highest bidder. But more importantly, those rights, once they get to the private party, are very liberal. The party, not the government, decides what radios can use and share these airwaves, what technologies can be deployed, what business models will be implemented, what applications can come onto the device or the phone, and the architectures of the network. That is all planned out by competing private firms. In the old days, the tradition was that has to be done by the regulator. Otherwise, you're going to get chaos. It turns out the opposite is true. That is to say, you cannot get the complexity of today's mobile market in particular with anything like the top-down regulation, command and control of the legacy market. Those old rules had to be opened up, and they were by regulatory visionaries, including Ronald Coase, who was a great economist, who was considered quite heretical in his day and even mocked and jeered for many, many years because he thought that maybe there's a better way to do this planning. Maybe decentralized spectrum property owners could really introduce more competition and innovation in a much more fluid system. And he didn't have a lot of empirical evidence to go on. It was really kind of theoretical, reading Adam Smith, talking about open markets and all the dynamism thereof. And it turns out, amazingly, Coase was right. And when other regulatory visionaries caught up to this and implemented new rules and allowed, in essence, for example, mobile carriers to be owners of radio spectrum and to do what they thought was commercially feasible in competition with their rivals, we cleared away the government roadblock. And we allowed, for example, the iPhone, made by Apple, put together 2005, 2006. The Apple doesn't work. The iPhone doesn't work without any radio spectrum. Okay, just add spectrum, but you have to have that wireless interface. Okay. Apple didn't have to go to the government. In fact, to this day, Apple has no government licenses, no spectrum allocation, no wireless base stations. They went to the market in the form of a contract with a carrier. And of course, they started with one, AT&T in the United States, and they're now with hundreds internationally. And they get paid. There's a market where they actually produce something so incredibly valuable to the customers of these networks that they actually get paid. Now, there's nothing theoretical about that. It's just an empirical outcome. It's exactly the sort of surprise you want the market, you desperately want the market to reveal, because nobody looking forward without evidence on this and ex ante before the actual market forces come into play can predict. But Apple created something that was so such amazing new stuff that the customers flocked to it, and even the businesses they were dealing with, the carriers, could see it and paid handsomely, still pay handsomely to get the iPhone. The point is, there's a market in radio spectrum like there never was before. And so the inventor with a better mousetrap does not have to stand in line asking permission at the government regulator. They can go right to the market and say, who wants to be my partner? Who wants to be a millionaire? What network? Well, all the networks want the iPhone because the customers love the iPhone.
And so if it hadn't been the marketization of allowing the market access to that radio spectrum, do you think we would have had the Apple App Store, for example? Do you think we would have had app-based, your likes of Uber, your likes of Lyft, whatever you want to here and across the pond rely on? Do you think they would have been here had it been for that opening up of competition?
Well, you know, it's a counterfactual, so you can't say for sure. Mm. I can say this for sure. It would not have gotten here as quickly and as fulsomely. And uh, I'm I'm personally convinced that we would still not have any of this innovation under the old system. The 1952 TV allocation table by the Federal Communications Commission was so rigid, and it's still in place, still blocking the use of airwaves for the transmission system that was popular in 1952. And so there are all these better technologies that come, and they can't get access to the old allocations. And the government doesn't do it because it's mean-spirited. It just does it because it is trying to keep order, and it is trying to be conservative, and it doesn't want to do anything too careless. And that's exactly the wrong direction we want to go. We want all kinds of risky investments to be made by owners, by people who actually invest their own capital, betting that a new technology will win and losing if it doesn't. Yeah. And when it turns out like an Apple investment or a Google Android investment or a Netflix investment, by the way, Amazon, these are all wireless giants today, and they have no investment in wireless facilities. That is the proof that a market has just blown up the old definitions and have delivered extraordinary value to society in a way that cannot be planned by regulators. In the old days of planning, there were the government knew exactly who the transmitters were and who owned them and exactly what they did, and they micromanaged all of that, and it went very slowly in terms of innovation. What's happening today is really just a different universe of biorhythms. It's a completely different clock.
Yeah. I wonder if you can talk now a bit about what is net neutrality and how do you think it's problematic here and in the US?
So there's concern in lots of markets, not just in communications or mobile or the internet, about what we call vertical issues. And vertical is when a company provides complementary resources. So you have Amazon, and they provide a retail platform to some of us who are Amazon addicts. We think it's fantastic. You can get up in the middle of the night. You can buy vitamins or large men's shoes with comfortable soles and be shipped anywhere quickly and efficiently. And yet, Amazon owns some of those products that it sells and delivers and provides the platform for retail, and it competes head-to-head with other sellers on its own platform. Will it kind of tilt the scales against the independent sellers? And there's a lot of argument that it might. Net neutrality is that argument in the internet. That is to say, we subscribe as end users that want to get on and do Google search or download a Netflix movie. We subscribe to an ISP, an internet service provider, and they might have a DSL service or fiber to the home or a cable modem on a cable TV system. And they might charge us in the United States $40 or $50 a month for access to the internet. Maybe they will have their own movie service and they will kind of give you better access to their movie service than to Netflix or some independent operator. Or they'll have their own search engine and they'll tilt the balance against Google. Or they'll tell Google, look, you can't go to our customers unless you pay us. So net neutrality is a policy that says, you know, that's going to happen. In fact, that's going to happen endemically. There's going to be a real problem with competition. All these upstarts on the edge of the net, they're not going to have the means to, you know, buy their way in and pay off British Telecom or Vodafone or in the United States Comcast or Verizon. And so we have to have rules that say everybody gets treated the same. There's no bit discrimination on these internet. It turns out that that's just really a bad idea because we have long experience with what is in the law very strongly is common carrier regulation, where discrimination by the platform, the ISP in this case, is regulated by the government and limited so as not to create monopolies in other parts of the market. From 1934 until 1974, AT&T was the U.S. telephone monopolist, and they were regulated as a common carrier under the 1934 Communications Act, Title II, Common Carrier Rules. And after 40 years, 1974, the biggest antitrust case ever filed in the history of the United States at that point was filed by the U.S. government against AT&T for monopolizing the telephone industry and having all kinds of discrimination. And of course they manipulated the... In fact, a lot of economists say that the case was really brought against the regulators for doing a bad... But that's the point. Common carrier regulation is not a panacea. In many cases, it actually stymied the internet, including protecting AT&T or discriminating against new ISPs. The first ISPs like AOL in the 1980s had to get a deregulation. Otherwise, they would be considered telephone companies. And they would actually be regulated like the big AT&T just as an upstart and have all kinds of obligations imposed on them. That would make it impossible. And so those upstarts lobbied to get deregulated. And in fact, voice over internet, the voice over internet entrepreneurs asked the Federal Communications Commission, please. They got an order in 2004, the Pulver Order, by Jeff Pulver, who became he was one of the great innovators in voice over internet. He wanted a rule that voice over internet was not a common carrier service and could not be regulated under the old rules. And that's how we've gotten so much innovation, competition, and openness. Now, a lot of what happens on these platforms when you subscribe through your ISP to the internet, a lot is very open and non-discriminatory. For the most part, they don't care what websites you're... What they care about is what the congestion, the network management is. And by the way, all the rules for network neutrality in the United States, and I'm pretty sure around the rest of the world, all the ones that I've seen, they always make exceptions that there can be discrimination amongst applications for reasonable network management, which of course is a customer exactly what you do not want, some spectrum hogging application or spectrum hogging user to come on and to take all the capacity of a shared network. You want pricing. You want some where there's not pricing to save you from the high intensity user. You want some other kinds of restrictions, which are not neutral. They will impinge on some more than others. Mm-hmm. Now, how reasonable it is, how competitive it is, those are interesting questions. So far, none of the net neutrality rules show me that the government is going to actually bring anything to the table. We want more competition. I've been arguing my entire career for more competition. I got into this game in the 1980s when I actually wrote a PhD dissertation in economics at UCLA that talked a lot about how much monopoly was being promoted through local cable franchises in the United States. And there were a lot of interests. In fact, many of those same interests are here today talking in favor of net neutrality. We don't have enough competition because we've had government barriers. We have eliminated some of those, not all of them. We need more elimination and more openness, and we need more spectrum. Because, of course, the great hope of the future is wireless technology saving the day with a fixed line broadband. And that's already happening with 4G. 5G is even more exciting. And there is no natural monopoly for wireless. Everybody knows that. And this idea that the old wireline networks were regulated as monopolies is a continuing legacy problem that really can be and should be solved to a very large extent with more aggressive spectrum policies to put competition and capacity in the market for 5G and all the Gs to come.
And that genuinely is fascinating. I mean, what lessons do you think the UK can learn from the American experience then? Because the debate seems to be a lot more, I do hope our listeners will forgive me for saying this, but a lot more advanced in America. I think you hear a lot more about net neutrality. You hear a lot more about these debates around competition in the market. Do you think that's a positive thing? Do you think there are some things that we are getting right in this country, and that's the reason why the debate isn't so pronounced? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the Brits should follow the U.S., but I say in my book, and I've said for a long time, the Americans should learn from the Brits, because in fact, yeah, by the 2000s, the Blair government commissioned an excellent 2002 radio spectrum review that Professor Martin Cave did here. It was very influential. It was very influential in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it talked about liberalization of spectrum rights and putting more bandwidth into the market. And And I cite it very favorably in my book. And in fact, the Nordic countries have all actually done very, very well in getting, you know, they're small countries and they have a little bit of an interest, particularly in with Nokia and Ericsson. They have an interest in Finland and Sweden in promoting lots of capacity and new technology. But they've gotten a lot of bandwidth out, and they've gotten pretty good competition, not in terms of large numbers of carriers so much, but large capacity, which drives down the marginal cost of services and really does deliver a high consumer benefit. And the basic point that they've discovered, and the Brits have had some backsliding on this and some of the same political problems we actually have in the United States, but what all countries should know is that there's no public purpose in locking up the spectrum. You're not saving it for anything. It's not exhaustible or depletable. You only waste the spectrum by locking it away and not using it, and it's the benefits are gone for that period of time forever. You're not making it back. So you need to put that spectrum out with flexible rights. It won't get locked in. If you have actual profit-seeking owners or other responsible parties, in some cases nonprofits can do this as well, and there may be political advantages to getting more spectrum out in some measures that way. But in normal market circumstances, the owners are going to have very strong incentives to discover what the best uses of the spectrum are. And they're constantly going to be investing in the discovery process, research and development, to see how those airwaves can be optimized. That's not true when you lock it up in the government warehouse. That just goes into oblivion, and you waste it. So the countries that are getting more spectrum, more bandwidth out, they're well served by that. And then all of the rest of us should take a look. I mean, the United States estimates it has a little over 700 megahertz, which is the standard measure of the most valuable spectrum in play for mobile. The Finns say they have 1,200 megahertz. And, you know, the atmosphere is fairly simple, similar everywhere on the planet. And the fact that the Finns are, you know, nearly twice as, you know, have twice as much bandwidth allocated, that speaks well of the regulatory process and their future prospects for getting more services, more capacity, and better product, better technology into the market. And the rest of us ought to take some learning from that.
Speaking of taking some learning, I wonder if to bring the podcast to a close, you could sum up for me what you would like to see from policymakers moving forward.
I think we should have some historical scope, and that is to say, we've made great progress from a system which was very cloistered and really did fear the future. And by allowing markets to exert themselves in the form of competition. Remember, just the 1980s, basically every country in the world, with a little bit of an exception for the United States with AT&T and the breakup we had in the early 80s, every country in the world still had, at the beginning of the decade, a PTT, a state monopoly controlling the post office, the telegraph, and the telephone. And of course, we had privatization from BTT to Deutsche Telekom to NTT all over the world. And then we got mobile. Mobile is not a natural monopoly. There is competition. There are private companies that actually bid for radio spectrum rights and then figure out how to optimize, build the best networks, allow the best applications and services. I think regulators everywhere, and scholars and political policymakers, they have to really get a grasp of how the closed system was so I don't want to say blindly, but so reflexively supported as though it was the only way to be done. And then the vision of sort of market thinkers like Ronald Coase come into this. They seem absolutely extraordinary that anybody can talk about markets replacing the central allocation function of governments in radio spectrum. But it just turned out he was dead right. And the benefits from decentralized innovation, some people call it now permissionless innovation, where you take away the mother may I system and you allow competition to be the governing factor, Yeah, there will be rules, and there'll be rules on radio spectrum, there'll be rules on privacy, there'll be a rule of law. And those rules should be adjusted as new technologies challenge them. Right now, one of the great challenges is how we use airspace literally for drones and how we fit new devices. I mean, you know, new delivery devices and transportation into those spaces. That's a very interesting question that some of us are thinking about, but there's no obvious answer. Society has to grapple, but stopping progress on a simple route that some kind of engineering solution can impose order, and that silence is a sign of success, which is what we had for decades when technologies were stifled, and that was good because we didn't get interference to other systems. That is exactly wrong. There's going to be a lot of tumult in a dynamic market, and there will be new rules that have to get hammered out. We should have good dispute resolution mechanisms, good public debate, and a good attitude about those challenges, because that's success, and we want more of it.
Professor Thomas Hazlett, thank you very much for joining me today. So basically, I think to summarize, we need to unleash the spectrum and get government out of the way. Now, you can let us know what you think by tweeting at IEA London, and you can also subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts.